You've played a key role in understanding the structure of the ribosome, for which you were awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 2009, together with Ada Yonath and Thomas Stites. How would you explain the ribosome movie to the general scientific community? And what was your contribution to achieving that understanding?
Yeah, so if you ask, you know, the average non-molecular biologist, even a scientist, even people from the physics community, what a ribosome is, almost nobody knows what a ribosome is. And this always struck me as very surprising, because everybody thinks they know what a gene is. You know, so if you ask someone, do you know what genes are? They say, yes, we know what genes are. They're things that give us our characteristics. We inherit it from our parents and pass it on to our children. But then you ask them, well, what exactly are genes? And most of them won't be able to tell you. Even most scientists won't actually be able to tell you. And the reality is, what genes are units of information. So each gene contains information for how to make a particular protein or how to regulate the making of a protein, you know, to make more of it or less of it and so on. And these instructions are encoded in our genetic material, which is a long molecule that everybody knows is DNA. So in a long DNA molecule, there'll be hundreds of genes, and they'll be represented as different sections of DNA. So each section that contains a gene contains information on how to make a particular protein or how to regulate it. This can be regarded as a large library of information. That's our genetic material. Now, if you were to go to the British Library and say, I want to borrow that book, they won't let you, because book is usually too valuable, it's original. And what they'll do is they'll make a copy of the book, and then you can read the copy and learn from that or to carry out instructions and so on. So the cell does something very similar. Although the genetic information is stored in DNA, it's copied. Each gene, as it's needed, is copied into a molecule called messenger RNA because it carries the genetic message. So it's a sort of messenger. And it goes from the nucleus to the outside of the nucleus that is called the cytoplasm of the cell. And there, a large molecular machine reads this genetic message and then, based on the instructions, stitches together a long polymer, which is a protein. A protein is a long polymer like DNA, but unlike DNA, it's only single-stranded instead of double-stranded. Whereas DNA consists of four types of bases, a protein consists of 20 types of amino acids. So it's a completely different sort of polymer. The process is called translation because you're going from the language of DNA, which is this, think of it as a sentence with only four letters in the alphabet, to a different kind of polymer which has 20 letters in its alphabet. So the process is called translation. So what the ribosome does is it's right at the crossroads of biology. It's the bridge between genes and the information they contain to making the products that are specified by the gene. Now, you asked what my contribution was. Well, ribosomes were discovered in the 1950s, but it's an enormously complex molecule. I mean, it's almost not correct to regard it as a molecule because it's an assembly of, you know, 80 or so molecules. And it's about 500,000 atoms. So it's, you know, incredibly complicated. And to understand how it works, just as with any other molecule, you want to know what it looks like, how it interacts with the genetic message, and how it stitches together amino acids to make a protein, and how it moves, etc. And to do that, you need to understand its structure. You need to be able to visualize what does ribosome actually look like, and not just in one state, but what does it look like as it's doing, it's carrying out its function. So that was a long, complicated effort. and it in the end required several groups to determine its high-resolution structure, and from there deduce some of the key functional mechanisms, like how it reads the genetic code, how it makes the peptide bond, that is, the bond between amino acids. Because of that, the Nobel Prize in 2009 was awarded to three groups. But I should say more than three groups actually contributed to the effort. But I think, you know, in terms of the high-resolution structure, these were the three groups that actually made the breakthroughs.
Could you explain how your research contributes or is important for antibiotics? And what are the key challenges in developing new antibiotics for superbacteria?
So, as we all know, the resistance to antibiotics, antimicrobial resistance, is a huge problem. In fact, about 25,000 people die in just Europe alone as a result of resistant infections. And so it is a big problem. And when you look at the antibiotics that are available, almost half of them target the ribosome or the protein synthesis machinery. Now, it turns out that because the ribosome is so old, ribosomes have diverged between bacteria and us. So our ribosomes are somewhat different. They're actually significantly different in some respects, but even in the core functional areas, there are sufficient differences between our ribosomes and bacterial ribosomes. And the result is there are a class of compounds that can bind to bacterial ribosomes and stop them from working, but they don't bind to our ribosomes as well, or they don't bind at all. And so the result is that a number of these antibiotics are useful to treat bacterial infections. When these structures came out of ribosomes, it was then very straightforward to determine the structure of the ribosome with various antibiotics bound. That part became just a straightforward extension of the original structure. And so for the first time, we could visualize in atomic detail how these antibiotics bound to the ribosome. That not only allowed us to understand how these antibiotics worked, but it also allowed us to understand why resistance would occur, you know, with a certain mutation, why these antibiotics would not work, or, you know, if the antibiotics were modified by some resistance mechanism.
And you also have a paper detailing the structure of the 70S with the...
But there are several structures now. The most cited paper is our original paper on the 30S,
yeah,
which was published in 2000. And the high-resolution structure of the entire ribosome came later. And it was actually Tom Steitz's lab at Yale that used that structure to determine a number of antibiotic structures. Now, the thing about developing new antibiotics is many drug companies, including one that was started by Tom Steitz and Peter Moore and others at Yale, have been trying to use these structures to design better antibiotics. Now, the problem is that it's not just a technical problem. It's also a business and economic problem. And the problem with development of new antibiotics is that if you develop a new antibiotic, you typically want to give it to patients for whom, you know, the standard antibiotics don't work. Because after all, they're a lot cheaper. You know, they've been around a while, they're generic and so on. And so the patient pool is actually quite small. And moreover, if you give an antibiotic to a patient, the patient is typically cured in a week or so, okay, if the antibiotic is any good. And so this is not a model for, you know, making a lot of profit. Okay? And as a result, you know, there's almost been no new class of antibiotics for almost 20 years, okay? It's because drug companies don't see this as a big profit-making venture, because they have to spend a huge amount of time, first of all, finding compounds, But even if they find a compound, it's very expensive to carry it through all the clinical trials and get approval for it to be a drug. Some estimate that it costs about $1 billion to develop a new medicine. And so they don't necessarily see, you know, a guarantee of a return on that sort of investment. So I believe that the problem needs to be tackled somewhat differently. And what we must remember is one of the first big antibiotics was penicillin. But penicillin was developed, you know, by a huge government initiative at Oxford during World War II. So there's no reason why governments or multinational organizations or big charities cannot get involved in antibiotic development, as was originally done with penicillin.
So in your book, you extensively discuss the importance of correctly crystallizing the ribosomal subunits. What approaches did you take in order to extract the ribosomal subunits and crystallize them, and what is the current state of the art?
We were somewhat fortunate in that we got initial crystals while trying to reproduce crystals that had been reported by a Russian group in the mid-1980s. But then we looked at these crystals and analyzed them and realized that these crystals were lacking a protein that was present in variable amounts in the ribosome. And so we removed this variable component completely so that we had very pure homogeneous particles. And then we, you know, crystallized them, and we crystallized them at 4 degrees C in the cold room so that they crystallized slowly. And we also then made sure that there weren't any contaminants that could degrade the particles while they were slowly crystallizing over several weeks. I mean, some of them took about 8 weeks to grow to full size. So I think that's what really gave us very good crystals. So I think it was a bit of luck, and it was a bit of being very careful with our sample preparation. There was no magic in it.
Can you explain what has been the role of synchrotron light in achieving our current understanding of the ribosome structure? And what are the current experimental workflows?
In 2000, or really any time until about 2011 or so, or 2012, it would have been impossible to solve the structure of the ribosome without a synchrotron, because the only technique that was capable of producing an atomic structure up to about 2010 or 2012 was by X-ray crystallography. And if you took a normal X-ray source, a laboratory-based X-ray source like a rotating anode, it simply doesn't have the coherence or the intensity to produce high-resolution diffraction from crystals of the ribosome, because the diffraction from ribosome crystals is too weak. And this is because the ribosome is such a large molecule that the unit cell, that is the repeating unit in the crystal, is very large. So for a crystal of a given size, there are fewer unit cells, there are fewer repeating units. And the ribosome crystals, because the molecule is very large and there are very few points of contact, it has lots of solvent channels, that is mostly water, between the crystals. So ribosome crystals can be, our small subunit crystals were about 70 or 75% water and only 25% ribosomes, actually. So this makes these crystals very weakly diffracting, so you needed synchrotrons. The other reason for using synchrotrons is that the way we determined the structure was by tuning the wavelength so certain special atoms in the structure would stand out. You know, it's a technique called anomalous scattering. And that, again, required synchrotrons, because with synchrotrons, you can choose the wavelength of the X-rays that you use very, very precisely. So you can fine-tune the X-ray wavelength. And so these two things meant that synchrotrons were indispensable for solving the structure. That is no longer true. So today, if you wanted to solve a ribosome structure, you wouldn't actually even go to synchrotron at all. What you would do is use a technique called cryo-electron microscopy, a lot of which was developed here at the LMB by Richard Henderson and his colleagues, for which Richard Henderson shared the 2017 Nobel Prize 2 years ago.
You have done work at a number of synchrotrons, and one of them is the ESRF. Could you talk about your work there and what beamline you've used and if you still apply for beam time there?
Well, I've used several beamlines at the ESRF. Most of them have the property that they're undulator beamlines, so they're typically prefixed with ID for insertion device. And the reason for that is these beamlines have very, very high intensity and high coherence. And that's what you need to get data of sufficiently good quality from ribosome crystals. We used to use ID14 quite a lot in the old days. And then ID29 came along, and now there are other beamlines as well. Whatever synchrotron, we've also used the Swiss light source, and notably we used the APS, the advanced photon source at Argonne National Lab, which gave us our initial phases for the 30S subunit. All of these synchrotrons have the same sort of characteristics, which is they have insertion devices to produce very high intensity and a very highly parallel coherent beam. I haven't applied for synchrotron beam time since about 2012 because my lab no longer primarily uses crystallography. In fact, we haven't done any crystallography for almost 6 or 7 years. And that's because we've shifted to cryo-electron microscopy.
And what about the looking at the evolution of a sample? Could you talk about the opportunities and challenges in situ and in vivo studies?
In vivo studies are mostly limited to light microscopy because light does not damage the molecule, and you can visualize, you know, various parts of the cell. Now there's a technique called super resolution microscopy, which allows you to label specific molecules inside the cell and see them at quite high resolution and see where they're distribution is, so you can watch things happening in the cell while the cell is alive, or sometimes you allow the cell to reach a certain stage and then you fix it. Okay. In terms of high resolution, the way to do it is to try and trap the cell in different stages and then, you know, freeze it and then look at it. And this is a technique in electron microscopy called tomography, which allows you to look at entire cells and look at where molecules are inside cells and even obtain, you know, structure of molecular complexes inside the cell as they exist. That wouldn't be called exactly in vivo because the cell's not really alive, but you could call it in situ because it's as it exists inside the cell.
Could you tell us a bit about what your research group is working on at the moment and what is the scientific question you're trying to answer?
So we are still working on ribosomes because it's often the case in research that when you make a breakthrough, it's not the end of the road. All it does is raise, you know, a completely different set of questions. And so there's no sort of endpoint in science, or at least not in most things. What we're looking at is how do ribosomes know where to start reading the message? And the way that's done is very different in bacteria and in human ribosomes or in yeast ribosomes. So yeast and us have more similarity because we're what are called eukaryotes. We're cells that contain a nucleus, and our ribosomes are more similar than those of bacteria. And so we're understanding this process called initiation, which involves a number of proteins that come and bind to the messenger RNA and to the small ribosomal subunit to bring it to the right starting point where it can begin translating the gene and making the protein. And it's a highly regulated process. And when it's deregulated, it can lead to things like cancer. Moreover, there are viruses that can hijack this initiation process by, you know, having their own kind of machinery that doesn't require all these protein factors from the cell. And the result is that all of the translation is diverted to translating the virus's own genes. And so it's a way for the virus to stop the ribosome from making the host proteins and start making the virus's proteins instead. And so this is a very interesting problem. And so where some of our effort is focused on that. We also have organelles in us called mitochondria, which are remnants of bacteria that were swallowed up by another cell about 2 billion years ago. And although they've been in us for 2 billion years, they still retain a small genome, and for that they have their own ribosomes, which translate their genes. And so these ribosomes have differentiated quite a lot from both bacterial ribosomes and from our own ribosomes. So they're interesting biologically. They're also important medically, because many antibiotics are toxic because they bind to our mitochondrial ribosomes, because they're sort of descendants of bacteria. So they're bacteria-like in some respects. And so antibiotics that normally might not be so toxic end up being toxic because they bind to our mitochondrial ribosomes. So it's important to understand their structure for that reason. And many genetic diseases map to mitochondrial ribosomes. So we solved the structure of mitochondrial ribosomes along with Nenad Ban's lab in Zurich. We were to some extent competitors, not collaborators, but friendly competitors. So these structures are now paving the way for understanding how mitochondrial ribosomes work and possibly how mutations in them might, you know, cause various diseases. So that's another area. And finally, we want to understand how cells are regulating translation. If ribosomes get stuck, how does a cell rescue ribosomes and, you know, regulate the whole process of translation and maintain quality control? How does it know when things have gone awry and, you know, you need to stop translation and start again? So these are sort of some of the areas we're working on.
Can you explain how interdisciplinary research has contributed to the structural resolution of the ribosome?
Well, the first thing I could say is that at the Nobel Prizes in 2009, the physics prize was given for the development of CCD detectors and for the development of fiber optics, which, you know, allows large amounts of data to be moved. Now, the interesting thing is that the X-ray detectors that we used to solve the structure of the ribosome at the time were based on CCD detectors. So you could see right away how developments in physics had helped, you know, solve an important problem in biology using a sort of, you know, physical method. So in that sense, interdisciplinary work is extremely important, in that discoveries made in one field will often be used to drive other fields. My own field, which is structural biology, is intrinsically interdisciplinary because it involves using physical techniques to attack biological problems. Sometimes what people mean by interdisciplinary is when people from different disciplines come together to attack a problem that neither of them could by themselves. And that can often happen spontaneously. You know, people who require analysis of data might go to a mathematician or a computer scientist and say, look, you know, I have this large-scale data and I don't know how to extract the information from it. And then, you know, they might collaborate. Or if you want to do some a particular sort of experiment, but you need some novel technique to attack it, you might go and talk to a physicist or a physical chemist, and they might say, well, actually, if you were to use this technique, it might help you obtain the kind of information you're looking for. So I think one has to be open-minded and encourage interdisciplinary work where it's needed. And that means lowering barriers to interdisciplinary work. But I'm not one of these missionaries who thinks that interdisciplinary work is always the answer or it should be promoted over everything else. That's just not the way science works. Some science is not interdisciplinary, and it's absolutely first rate, and it's making great advances. And other science, you know, by definition, is interdisciplinary. Science shouldn't be wedded to particular models. Rather, its goal is to not inhibit interactions. If there's a barrier between talking to physicists and chemists and engineers and so on, that's not a good thing. But if you remove these barriers, then things will happen, spontaneously as needed.
And speaking of collaboration, can you talk about the importance of international cooperation in research?
Well, I think for many things, collaboration is essential. We ourselves are now collaborating with two groups. We've been collaborating with one group at the NIH on initiation of translation in yeast for certainly over 15 years. And we've begun a collaboration with how this process works in human ribosomes with a group in California. These groups provide complementary expertise. We're focused on solving structures, but they have a lot of biochemical expertise and they can also do genetics. So, there is quite a lot of natural collaboration. But then there's also other collaborations, such as collaboration that involves very large-scale work, like the Human Genome Project was a very large-scale collaboration. Or, the discovery of the Higgs boson involved scientists from many different countries working at CERN, to attack this rather difficult problem. Or the discovery of gravitational waves involved, scientists from lots of different countries, and in fact, even equipment was based in lots of different countries to obtain a result. So science can vary from very small-scale independent efforts which require no collaboration, but simply require, one or few scientists to be really quite original and do their thing, to others which require large-scale collaboration. There isn't a one-size-fits-all model for science. And I think we shouldn't try to impose collaboration. That's not the way science works. In some cases, you'll need it. In other cases, individuals working even by themselves are going to make major contributions.
So could you talk about then the role of government on long-term investment in basic research?
I think, governments invest in research because they know that it's good for the economy. Most Western countries prosper not because of cheap labor or raw materials, but because of knowledge. And if you look at the growth of Europe, for most of history, China and India were among the top, economic countries in the world. And suddenly you see in the 1700s and 1800s, Europe emerging as a big powerhouse and becoming the world's largest economy, and then was taken over by the U.S. around the early 1900s. And all of this has to do with the idea that knowledge is important for economic growth, and it's what drives economic growth. And governments all realize that, but governments are under pressure. They need to They want to spend money, but they also want to know what can you get out of it. And what governments need to realize is that virtually everything that you see today as part of driving the economy, major parts of the economy, they all came out of some basic curiosity-based research. I mean, if you look at something as simple as electricity, Michael Faraday, when he was discovering the laws of induction, didn't have the idea that it's going to become a multi-trillion dollar industry worldwide. Okay, and it's the same with batteries, or if you look at these video cameras, and you look at all of the inventions that go into a digital camera, the computers, the CCD chips, all of these things came out of basic science. It's the same with medicine, a fundamental understanding of physiology and cell biology and genetics has led to transformative, things in medicine, advances in medicine. So what I would argue is that, yes, it's very important to take basic research and make sure that it's used for applications, and that applications are developed, that they're commercialized in a way that benefits everybody. But it's also important to realize that the future transformations in the economy are going to come out of the basic science of today. And so we have to realize that a fraction of the research budget must always be set aside for very fundamental research, because we have no idea what it'll lead to. I mean, the idea that high-energy physicists at CERN, because they wanted to share data, invented a protocol that now results in the World Wide Web, it was not predictable, okay? And it happened because of fundamental investment in fundamental science. So I think governments need to always keep that in mind. And just as a farmer always has to set aside seed corn for next year's harvest, you don't want to use it all up.
And so how can we convince then governments to, especially in some developing countries, including resource-rich countries, to invest in fundamental research?
Well, I think we in Britain are doing a fairly good job. And I think in the US, there's always been a recognition that, for example, the National Institutes of Health, which is really for medical research, yet invests a huge amount of money in basic science. So I think there is a recognition. I wouldn't say that there isn't. But I think there is a danger. There are other countries which, don't see the value of basic science, and I think they're mistaken. They will never become first-rate economies unless they invest in a healthy mix of basic and applied science. Countries like Singapore, South Korea, China, they've all, invested in basic research, also starting from nowhere. They also started from, very little. There's very little research going on in all three of these countries, and they're all big powerhouses now, So I think it requires enlightened leadership at the top, and it requires them to then hire good scientists, first-rate scientists, maybe even from the West or returned from the West. But then they've got to give them independence and they have to trust them. And that's sometimes hard for some countries.
Public engagement in science, why is it important?
Well, it's important for two reasons. One is, I think the fundamental reason is science is part of our culture. It's part of the culture of humanity that we know things. We know, for example, how we actually inherit, traits. I mean, at the molecular level, that was amazing. For centuries, no one understood why children were more similar to their parents than, to other people and so on, or why we didn't give birth to animals instead of human beings, right? So nobody understood that. And now, we understand these things at a molecular level. We understand how the universe might have begun, with, the Big Bang and so on. We understand how evolution works. We understand the nature of molecules. People until the 19th century didn't even know about molecules. So these are all amazing triumphs of human understanding. You know, if you went back 200 years and told people, you know, we understand how the universe began and the molecular basis of heredity and, you know, how, you know, physiology works and so on, they would think we were magicians, okay? So I think that's one reason to convey the excitement of science and the knowledge, which is really part of, you know, all of humanity. And the second reason is that in nearly all countries, science is supported by the public through taxes. So it is really our duty as scientists to inform the public what is going on in science. You know, how are we using your money to make discoveries and make advances and, you know, occasionally improving life in various ways? You know, so I think that's just part of our, you know, contract with the public, if you like.